Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Leonard Perlmutter, founder of the American Meditation Institute in Averill Park, New York. Perlmutter has been leading meditation and yoga courses for more than three decades. Perlmutter is also author of The Heart and Science of Yoga, a blueprint for peace, happiness, and freedom from fear. Leonard Perlmutter, thank you so much for being here. So let's start it off and learn a little, as I always love to do, about who I'm talking to. So who are you? Where were you born? Who were your parents? What were they up to? And why have you become what you've become?
Well, I was born in Albany, raised in Albany, went to Albany Public Schools, School 19 on New Scotland Avenue, Hackett Junior High School at the time on Delaware, and graduated from Albany High School. Went off to college in Washington. Thought I was going to become Secretary of State.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to American University, got degrees in political science and international relations, and then went to George Washington University Law School. I was very dissatisfied with the law. I worked.
Did you graduate from law school?
I did not graduate. I went 2 years and came back to Albany to clerk my way through the bar.
Which is another way you could do it.
Exactly. 2 years of clerking equals 1 year of law school.
So if that's the case, did you pass the bar? I mean, did you take
the
bar?
No, I actually only clerked for 1 year and became very disenchanted really from the beginning with the law and started a newspaper in Albany. I founded the Washington Park Spirit newspaper that was published from 71 to 75 in Albany. It was a community newspaper, alternative newspaper, and I did that for 5 years. And during the recession of 74-75, finances were such that it was no longer feasible to continue the newspaper. We did a lot of great things in Albany, starting neighborhood associations, the Pinksterfest Festival, the Historic Albany Foundation that we founded, a lot of great efforts by a lot of wonderful people. But it was time to move on, and it was an important time for me. My father had died a few years previous, and it was a time of deep contemplation for me. Those questions that perennially are asked by individuals: who am I, from where have I come, why am I here, what's to be done, and where am I going, seemed to resonate in my consciousness and kept calling me. And so I took a little time to delve into philosophy, which had always interested me. Born in the Jewish tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, I began to rediscover those roots as well as Eastern roots, looking for some semblance of what the truth was to help guide me. And at the time, although I didn't realize that the activities that I was undertaking was actually yoga science, myself and my wife, Janice, began to homestead. We raised our own food. We raised our own animals.
And where'd you do that?
We did that in Averill Park. We moved out to Averill Park, over the river and through the woods from Albany. And we bought a little place in 1975. It cost us $30,000. We got 5 acres and a tractor and a barn.
Wow.
And so it was the best investment we ever made.
How old are you?
I am 64.
So were your parents, what did they do for a living?
My dad was an entrepreneur. He started in the theater business. He was an exhibitor. He owned theaters in the North Country, Lake George and those environs. And then in his later years, he was in the restaurant business and ran restaurants and cafeterias in state buildings.
Did your mom work?
She worked at the legislature for about 25 years.
What'd she do there?
She worked in the assembly for several different individuals, representatives.
Interesting. Okay, so now I am staring at this wonderfully huge volume called The Heart and Science of Yoga, a Blueprint for Peace, Happiness, and Freedom from Fear. And you've written this with your wife.
I have, yes.
And there's a lot of different yoga around. We have the wonderful Kripalu in our region. We have so many other individual practitioners who are practicing. But you use an interesting term here, which is the science of yoga.
Yes.
Look, there are people who think yoga is dangerous, that you can stretch, you can hurt yourself, that it has a downside to it also. What do you make of that?
Well, I think that's accurate. There are a lot of people, as in every walk of life, that are doing things that they should be doing other things. The cornerstone of yoga science is a relationship between a competent teacher and an interested student. And the reason for that is as you have mentioned, that there can be dangers in any endeavor. And a competent teacher is a competent teacher because that individual, he or she, can understand the limitations of the student and only give that student that which is easy for that student to deal with at a particular time. And in our culture, it's very fashionable to think of yoga as exclusively physical exercises. That is a part of the science of yoga, but it's only a small part. We do have a physical body, and it's necessary to deal with the physical body, to exercise it, to keep it in tip-top shape. But all of yoga really is about the mind, because even the body is a projection of the mind. I think about the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. This is for a government agency, has come out publicly and stated that at least 53% of illness is related to lifestyle choices. And that's about the mind. It's about decisions. It's about choices. And wouldn't that be wonderful if we could teach and inspire people to make different kinds of choices, how that would affect not only their health, but also the economic health of the country?
How do you make a living?
I make a living by selling paintings.
Is that right?
My wife is an artist, and I'm an art dealer by profession. And the American Meditation Institute that we founded in 1996 is a labor of love. So all of our time is donated to that, as many other people, to make it happen. But we make a living by selling paintings, selling my wife's paintings.
And where do you do that from?
We do it from Avril Park. We have a few people that come to Avril Park, but most of our sales come through galleries in other parts of the country.
So the American Meditation Institute, tell us a little bit about why you formed it, what it's doing, and where you're going to be going with it.
Well, why it was founded. We started investigating the science of yoga back in the 70s, after the Washington Park Spirit had ceased publication in 75, we began to study in depth the science of yoga. And we found a teacher by the name of Swami Rama of the Himalayas that would summer in Pennsylvania. We never met him until 1991. We studied his work from the 70s into the 80s and into the early 90s without meeting him because, actually, both Janice and myself, I guess you could say we had a little bit of an allergic reaction to gurus. We were always very self-reliant, and we found that if we could read and study and practice what seemed right to us, we didn't need an outside teacher, that the teacher we felt was ourselves. And that worked fine, and we soon discovered that that's what yoga is about, is about self-reliance, relying on yourself. But by 1990, we had been cutting back on a lot of different kinds of relationships, business relationships, personal relationships, based on the fact that we no longer wanted to be in service to fear.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that anybody who's in business will agree from their own personal experience that some of the decisions that they make are based on fear that they might not get what they want or that they might lose what they have. And what yoga presents is an opportunity to live fearlessly. And we learned to live fearlessly simply by taking actions that will enable us to fulfill the purpose of our lives without pain, without misery, without fear.
So I'm sorry, Leonard Perlmutter, but I'd love it if you would make the connection between basically stretching exercises and living without fear.
When an individual acts in the world in ways that are in conflict with his or her own inner wisdom, there is a contraction in the mind, and that contraction echoes within the consciousness of every cell of the body. And so the inflexibility of the mind to serve one's own truth creates inflexibility in the muscles that creates a body that does not act in optimal ways. The more that you become more flexible mentally by willingly giving up habits that conflict with your inner wisdom, giving up unnecessary fear, giving up unnecessary anger, giving up unnecessary desires, so that your outer action actually conforms with your inner wisdom, you become more flexible mentally, and also you become more flexible physically.
So which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, yoga would say that the mind comes first, because
really?
All of the body is in the mind. The body is a projection of the mind.
But you teach yoga.
Yes.
So when somebody does the, I'm going to make something up because I don't really know about them, but the bending dog or the downsized dog, whatever, that comes after you have done your mental exercise. Is that what you're saying?
Actually, the hatha yoga, the postures, actually is a preliminary in the systematic procedure leading up to meditation.
So what is the systematic procedure leading up to meditation? What do you do?
Okay, well, now, I've been doing this for many years, so it's not for everybody. Again, everybody should start with where they're at, honoring the limitations. But for myself, for example, I get up in the morning and I take care of my ablutions. I empty the bladder, I wash, and then I do prayers. And then I do some stretching.
Let's talk about the prayers for a minute.
Okay.
What are the prayers?
Well, prayer is a very integral part of yoga. There's two types of prayers. The one that most of us are familiar with is an ego-centered prayer. It's a petitionary prayer. And that type of praying starts when we're very young. It might start out, for example, when the child asks mommy for a cookie. Mommy, can I please have a cookie? Please have a cookie. Please, mommy, can I have a cookie? And then mommy says, okay, honey, here's a cookie. I love you. And you say, oh, thank you, mommy. I love you, too. And in part, what are we being trained to become? We are trained to become beggars. So we might be in the middle of our life, the economy might be a little tight, we have children going to school, and we have an opportunity to get a new job. So we file an application for that job, and we have people writing all sorts of flowery endorsements about what a great person we are. And we have an interview, and then we wait to hear whether we get the job or not. And in that interim, while we're waiting, and we get a little worried, am I going to get the job, am I not going to get the job, we decide to pray. Dear God, please let me get this job. Please let me get this job. Please let me get this job. And if we're creative enough, we can do a little deal with God. We can play a little Monopoly game. We can trade off something. Dear God, if you give me this job, I will do this and I will do that and I will stop doing this and I will stop doing that. That's one type of prayer, but that's not the type of prayer that yoga science asks of us. Because what yoga says is the only thing that any human being can legitimately pray for is strength. Strength to conform one's outer actions with one's inner wisdom. If we have the strength to base our outer actions on our inner wisdom, the promise is, and this is the cornerstone of the Judeo-Christian tradition from the prayer called the Shema, that if you do what is to be done, when it is to be done, everything you need will come to you. The wine, the corn, the oil, even the grass in the field for your cattle, and they'll be satisfied as well. But if you serve other gods, the gods of fear, the gods of anger, the gods of selfish desire, and your outer actions are in conflict with inner wisdom, then there's dis-ease in the mind, and there will be dis-ease in the body until you begin to examine the conflict. Because from a yogic perspective, inner conflict is the mother of all problems. If there's conflict in the mind, and we continuously murder our conscience, and I'll talk about that in a moment because that's an important element. If we keep on going against our own conscience, that inner conflict has to project outer conflict. You could call that outer conflict Osama bin Laden. You could call it Adolf Hitler. You could call it Timothy McVeigh. But the point is that as each individual, individually and collectively, go against our inner wisdom, somewhere in the human organism, there has to come a shared experience of pain as a consequence of the painful actions that we have taken inwardly.
So let me take you back to you were saying the prayer. You were distinguishing between sort of external supplication prayer and what you do, the science of yoga prayer. Now, we understand now from listening to you what the outer supplication is, and I can certainly relate to understanding that. Mm-hmm. But now tell us a little bit more about what you do.
Okay. Just as an example, I'll use myself as an example. No one knows better than Leonard, me, what type of fear is in my mind in certain kinds of circumstances. No one knows better than me what type of situations make me angry. No one knows better than me what type of situations cause greed to come forward from the unconscious to the conscious. So therefore, I am intimately aware of these forces that presently reside in the unconscious mind that are not consciously known to me, and yet they manipulate strings that cause this marionette that we call Leonard to act in certain ways that are actually counterproductive to his health and his well-being.
Now, this is great stuff. Because,
yes.
But what I don't understand is some people spend their life in psychoanalysis because they can't find out what their unconscious is telling them.
Well, every relationship that comes to you, every relationship that comes to you is the consequence of a previous action that brings about a force from the unconscious to come into the conscious mind. Once that force has come into the conscious mind, now you can do something with it. Now you can transform it. Because fear, anger, and greed, they're not bad. They are energy. They're our creative energy in an improper form. So we learned in fifth grade that energy cannot be created nor destroyed. But it can be transformed. And we can transform the power of fear and anger and selfish desire through the act of sacrifice, renunciation. So this is the type of prayer that yoga scientists engage in. Every day you contemplate and you take a look, you examine your internal world. What type of fear is coloring your actions? What type of anger is coloring your actions? What type of selfish desires are coloring your actions? This is what is called contemplation. You contemplate these types of actions, these types of missteps that you have taken in the past, and then you repent. You basically repent simply means I will not repeat. When I am in a similar circumstance, I will serve my inner wisdom rather than serve these unconscious forces. And you offer in a form of sacrifice to the higher power that is within you. You offer the fear, you offer the anger, you offer the selfish desire. And the act of renunciation is the mechanism for transforming the once debilitating power of fear, anger, and greed into strategic reserves of energy, willpower, and an expansion of your creative processes. When you give up fear, when you give up anger, when you give up selfish desires through the act of prayer, those reserves of energy, willpower, and creativity are deposited into three individual bank accounts in the subtle world that have your name on it. And so it's like banking. It's like when we were kids, when I was at school 19, we used to bring our passbooks in every other week. And we weren't banking hundreds of dollars at a time. It was whatever we could come up with, pennies, nickels, dimes, quarters. We started in September, and in June, we had some money in the bank. We had a couple hundred dollars in the bank. It was terrific. And it taught us that if we can simply do what's available to us, that's easy. What was easy at the time was pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters. But you keep on adding it each week after week after week. By the end of the school year, you have something. And it's the same with yoga science. When you're driving to work and you're a little bit late and you catch a red light and anger comes into your awareness, okay, that force has made its way. Anger has made its way from the unconscious to the conscious mind. So what yoga would say is it's an act of divine providence that red light asked you to stop. Why? So that you would have a relationship with anger, so that you could examine anger in your life, so that you could sacrifice it and be free of it.
We are talking to Leonard Perlmutter. He and his wife, Janice Cortez Perlmutter, have written a book, The Heart and Science of Yoga, a Blueprint for Peace, Happiness, and Freedom from Fear. Okay, but Freud, Leonard, talked about false consciousness. How do I know that, you know, when somebody is approaching me here at the radio station and they call up and they say, you're no good left wing, this or that, and then we get a natural sort of fight or flight response in our body. So sometimes you know enough to go your way, ignore them. Sometimes you say, this poor person has a problem of their own. Sometimes, however, you scratch the itch and you let them have it. Sometimes you get frightened and you wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning and you think you're processing all of this and you think about it. How do we know that your response to fight them at some point in your life is not legitimate. If somebody came along and threatened you or threatened your wife or took out a knife, you would have to call upon fighting as a reserve, wouldn't you, in anger?
Before you can legitimately address that question, you first and foremost have to know who you are in every circumstance. You have to put the horse in front of the cart rather than the cart in front of the horse. Most human beings are identified with their personality, with their bundle of habit patterns, with their fears and their anger and their selfish desire, and they think that that's them.
Do you have no selfish desire?
I explained that Leonard does have selfish desire. He does have fear. He does have anger. The beautiful thing about yoga as a science and as a philosophy is it teaches you how not to be enslaved to it. So it's not that you're not aware of it, but you don't continue to serve it. Rather, you can transform it. So the important thing is to recognize that each of us, each human being, is a citizen of two worlds. We have a body, we have a mind, we have habit patterns, but all of those are subject to change, death, decay, and decomposition. And yet within us, there is something that has been present every single day of our lives that has never changed. And what yoga asks us to do is to look at that aspect. And what that aspect is the fact that I am. Even though I'm a different height, even though I'm a different weight, even though some days I'm happy, some days I'm sad, some days I'm angry, some days I'm forgiving, sometimes I'm a teacher, sometimes I'm a student, all of those things change. And yet the fact that I am has always been true. It was true when I was 2. It was true when I was 22, 32, 42, 52, 62.
So I'm sorry, Leonard, you have to go slow with me, but okay. When you say I am,
yes,
what does that mean?
It means that there is an aspect of us, our consciousness, which transits time and space and never changes.
So if Freud said, I hate to keep going back to him,
go ahead.
But if Freud said that character is set in us by the time we're 4, mm-hmm. and now for the rest of our lives, if we were angry when we were 4 or whatever, mm-hmm. it's with us, mm-hmm. how does Freud and yoga get sort of codified, get equalized?
Well, those forces are there when we're 4, but they are changeable. And that's the beauty of the system. We can change them. It's not written in stone. So if you are angry, if you're fearful, or if you're greedy, you're invested in poverty, and you think that nothing is enough, like a Bernie Madoff type of a syndrome, that you can transform that power if you have a philosophy of life that can encourage you, rather than act on those forces, to sacrifice them and transform them into an expansive and helpful force.
Okay, so let's talk about meditation. You teach courses at Cranwell. People come from all over for this. So I guess I want to ask you what the techniques that you teach are.
Well, first, we teach people about the mind. We teach people that our conscience, which we're very familiar with, actually acts as a mirror that reflects wisdom from the center of consciousness. We've heard that we have a soul. We're taught in churches, and we're taught in synagogues, and we're taught in mosques that deep within us is this soul, which is part of God. And what yoga says is that our conscience is the conduit between that inner wisdom that religionists and theologians refer to as God. The conscience is the conduit that has the capacity to reflect that inner wisdom and reflect it into our conscious mind. So, for example, when your conscience tells you something, you don't need a PhD degree to know that it's true. You don't need a college degree to know that it's true. You don't even need a high school degree to know that it's true. What you need is the willpower to serve it.
I mean, I'm sorry to give you a hard time about this,
that's
but
fine.
What if you're a fool? I mean, what if you're what if you're an angry person who votes for open racist for governor of New York, for example, and that's part of your soul and your character. You're convinced because of who you are, you know, that Jewish people are bad or black people mm-hmm. are bad or whatever else, and you serve it the way you've just said it. How do you understand, how do you differentiate between real truth and the truth that you somehow assimilated for your whole life?
Through practice, what you do is you start with seemingly insignificant no-brainers. It's 10 o'clock at night. You're watching a little television, and a Maxwell House coffee commercial comes on. And you love coffee, and all of a sudden a desire for a cup of coffee comes into your awareness. Well, it's 10 o'clock at night. Are you going to have that cup of coffee? Are you going to serve that desire, or are you going to sacrifice it? Well, what you're taught through meditation skills is to detach yourself from the desire and redirect your consciousness to your conscience, which will tell you at 10 o'clock at night that the caffeine and the coffee is not the best idea for you because it will keep you up. You have an important meeting at 10 o'clock the next morning, so you'll sacrifice that. It was a no-brainer. It was black and white. And the more that you sacrifice that type of desire, the debilitating force of that desire is transformed into energy, willpower, and an expansion of your creativity. You have more and more access to what yoga science refers to as the superconscious portion of the mind, the same portion of the mind that Albert Einstein used to see mathematical equations, the same portion of the mind that Paul McCartney uses to hear beautiful melodies. It doesn't mean that you or I are going to become mathematicians or songwriters. What it does mean is that the more that we use our conscience to determine our actions, more creative ideas come to us that will directly, positively, and expansively influence every single unique relationship that we have. Now, the more that I purify my own mind to allow that divine consciousness to come forward through actions, I change the consciousness of the planet, because there is only one consciousness. You have a different body than I do. You have a different mind than I do. You have different habit patterns than I do. You have a different personality than Leonard does. But all of those things are constantly changing. And yet within Alan and within Leonard, there is this I am-ness that is actually part of an ocean of consciousness. You and I are really one. That's why Jesus the Christ says, love thy neighbor as thyself. Not because it's a cool idea, but because on the highest level of consciousness, Alan is me. Leonard is you. There is only one relationship. So every relationship that you have is with yourself. Now every individual sees a different universe because of the lenses through which they are viewing reality. And for a yoga scientist, you're simply asked, it's an internal process, you're simply asked to do what you are being asked to do. And the more that you purify your instrument, you free yourself from these unconscious forces, and in the process, you change the consciousness of the planet.
So a lot of people have come along, Leonard Perlmutter, and they have said some things like what you're saying. So, for example, for a while, there was a wave of transcendental meditation that you mentioned the Beatles. Mm-hmm. They went to see to try it out.
Yes.
So what is the difference, then, between yoga science and all of the other inward-looking spiritual approaches that we have been bathed in over these years?
The core of all of them is the same. Every religion on the face of the earth is based on yoga science. Even Muhammad, through interpretations, talked about two types of jihad. The lower jihad, which most people subscribe to today, which is the cause of so much trouble in the world because it runs the risk of being ego-oriented. That's only one form of jihad.
And explain that lower jihad a little bit more. The reason it's trouble is?
Is that that it runs the risk of eliminating the discriminative faculty of the conscience from making choices, because the counterpoint to it is the higher jihad, which is actually yoga science. It's all about purifying the individual mind, not worrying so much about what the other guy is doing, but how much fear am I exhibiting? How much anger am I exhibiting? How much selfish desire am I exhibiting? And if I can purify my own instrument, then the actions I take will be non-injurious.
There was a guy the other day, made all the newspapers, who got up in the middle of the night, I believe it was in Queens or Long Island, heard a sound downstairs, had a registered weapon, took it out, saw two guys robbing him, and one of them was holding a gun, and he shot him. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at your yoga science and see whether or not any of those actions could have been avoided or whether they were appropriate.
Well, every action that we take brings about a consequence. So for me to comment on a hypothetical...
It wasn't a hypothetical. That's what happened.
Yeah. But I can't comment on that. I don't know.
Asking you whether or not you're calling for what I might call universal disarmament. In other words, I find your argument very appealing, very mm-hmm. appealing. I'm afraid a lot of the times. Mm-hmm. I'm fearful when some jackass mm-hmm. does something, and you know, I have to appeal to my sense of rationality, yes. as you would recommend, as to whether or not to do this or not. But I worry that if, in fact, you disarm yourself mm-hmm. from some of these basic emotions, that you leave yourself at risk.
It's about intention. If it is your intention to be non-injurious and to be an instrument of love, and you subscribe to the highest principle of all of yoga, which is ahimsa. Himsa itself means violence. Ahimsa is the negative, non-injury, non-violence. Every thought, word, and deed is to be non-injurious. However, you have to apply that to yourself, too. That means that by being a doormat to someone else's ignorance, as in this scenario that you described, that's not kind to yourself. And so you always have to take yourself into consideration. And the teaching story that is often mentioned here is the story of the sage and the snake. The sage is walking through this little village. And the townspeople come up and they ask the sage to speak to the snake because the snake is biting all the children. And the townspeople can't get their wares to market. So the sage says, okay, I'll go talk to the snake. And he calls the snake over. And he starts talking to the snake. And he starts reminding the snake that ahimsa, non-injury, non-harming, is the highest principle of all of yoga. And this is what is going to make him happy and help him fulfill his life. And so the snake says, I understand, and I'm going to try to conform to ahimsa, non-injury, non-harming. And the sage leaves. A couple of months later, the sage comes back to the village, and in the middle of the road is the snake. And he is lacerated, and he is breathing his last breath. And the sage goes over to the snake, and he says, my friend, what has happened? He says, oh, you told me about ahimsa. You told me not to bite anymore, and I didn't bite, but the kids threw stones at me, and they lacerated me with sticks. And the sage said, well, I told you not to bite, but I never said, don't hiss.
Well, yeah.
So it's about intention. It's about intention. Why should I be subject to your ignorance? I love you so much that I am going to have to say no to you. I am not going to allow you to hurt yourself and hurt me in the process. So my motivation is not anger and it's not fear, it's love.
We're talking to Leonard Perlmutter, The Heart and Science of Yoga. Much earlier in this interview, Leonard, you talked about how you have certain natural aversions to gurus or fears of gurus. Why is that?
Well, I didn't know them.
But do you have a natural aversion? Is the science you're basically talking to us about today of yoga, it's an individual science.
That's correct.
As opposed to a leadership persona.
That's driven. Yes.
So that's where I want to go.
The best teachers are mirrors that redirect the student's awareness back to themselves to help the student learn that the best knowledge that they have in directing their own path is within themselves. It's exactly what Shakespeare says and has taught us for centuries. Above all else, to thine own self be true. It's all about understanding that the knowledge that we have is already within us. If we can only go within, find it through our conscience, and then act on it in the world and sacrifice the fear, sacrifice the anger, sacrifice the selfish desires, then the promise is we'll be able to fulfill the purpose of our lives.
So tell me a little bit more about the physical yoga as opposed to the spiritual yoga.
Well, physical yoga is spiritual yoga. Every action that we take is a spiritual act. What yoga science is asking us to do is to spiritualize every relationship. So all of life becomes yoga, every relationship, including the relationship with the body.
But all those people who show up every Saturday morning to do these stretching and these poses and the rest of it, most of them, I would think, are not there as a spiritual exercise.
That's correct.
And I wondered if you talked to us about that.
Well, we have a very physical culture. So it's very understandable that the first wave of yoga to reach our shores is going to be the physical exercises. That's, you know, it's just common sense. But there's a new wave that's coming, which is the broader science of yoga, which contains the physical postures. And traditionally, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, the physical postures are meant to be integrated into a systematic procedure with washing, doing our ablutions, doing prayers, stretching, doing some breathing exercises, all leading the mind and the body to focus, rest, stability, and comfort so that you can meditate.
Okay, let's get specific. Teach us about meditation.
Okay. In meditation, we do something that we rarely ever do. We close off the senses. We're still aware, we're still conscious, but we're not receiving stimulation through the eyes, the nose, the mouth, the ears, and the hands. Now, sensory input is a tremendous amount of stimulation that titillates the conscious mind. We're, in fact, in our culture, we're addicted to sensory input. And in meditation, we close those doors.
How you do it? Specifically, tell us what you do in the morning,
okay,
what people should do.
Okay. When you sit for meditation, you first and foremost need to find a posture that is comfortable and stable so that the body itself will not be calling your attention. We teach people to sit in a chair because Westerners, including myself, we are at this point less flexible in the hips and the knees than people in the East. In India, in Japan, in China, Korea, even adults, they entertain on the floor. When I was a child growing up in Albany and my parents had friends come over and I was on the floor, it was seen as an act of disrespect to our company. Get up off of the floor, Leonard, sit in the chair or in the sofa, be a good young man. So we have little hang-ups about the body. So you want to find a posture that is stable and comfortable so that the body doesn't call your attention. Then you close the eyes, and that effectively closes off the ears, the mouth, the sense of touch and smell. And you pledge to yourself that during this two-minute meditation, this one-minute meditation, that I'm going to give my full and complete undivided attention to a mantra. A mantra is a word or a series of words. It's a vibration that contains a perfect harmonic. You know, in the New Testament, John says, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. So physicists are telling us today that everything is vibration. There really are no individual forms. Everything is a seamless whole. It's all vibrations. Well, within this sea of vibrations, there are perfect vibrations, perfect harmonics, somewhat analogous to the tuning fork that the second or third grade teacher used to hit on the desk and bring it up to her ear to hear that perfect pitch of C before we all did our songs. So the mantra does three things when you give your attention to it. It generates love and fearlessness and strength. Love and fearlessness and strength. So the more conscious attention you give to the mantra, in the unconscious mind, you create a new habit of love and fearlessness and strength.
So the people who are listening to us now, some know what a mantra is, but give us an example of what a mantra might be.
In the Christian tradition, just the name of Jesus or the Hebrew, Yeshua, is a mantra. In the Hebrew tradition, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. In the Hindu tradition, Rama, which is the highest ideal of the human being. Allah is another mantra from the Islamic tradition. So there are many words that have this perfect harmonic. And the more you give your conscious attention to it, as your senses are closed off, you create a new habit in the unconscious mind. Now, it just so happens that the unconscious mind is connected to the conscious mind. What does that mean? It means that when we sit for meditation, and even though we close off the senses, and we are giving our conscious attention to the mantra, generating love and fearlessness and strength, and this is all very positive, the conscious mind, which is addicted to stimulation, becomes bored very quickly. That's why we have 300 channels on the television sets today, you see, because we're always looking for something more pleasing. So even though there's not that sensory input, the mind has a world, millions of experiences stored in the unconscious mind. So you're sitting, you're closing off the senses, you're listening to the mantra, you're gaining love and fearlessness and strength, and all of a sudden a little bubble comes forward from the unconscious mind into the conscious mind because it becomes bored with the mantra, and it says, hey, what's for dinner? Now, food. I like food. I like to think about food for a little while. What am I going to have for dinner tonight? Am I going to have Chinese food? Am I going to have Indian food? Am I going to have Italian food? And at a certain point during your meditation, you recognize that, wait a minute, all this thinking about food is not your mantra. So now you have a new relationship that is competing with the mantra. What are you going to do with that? If you keep on giving your attention to the food in your meditation session, then you're not meditating. Well, how am I going to get rid of this thought? Well, if you push it away, that's an injurious act. You don't want to do that. What you want to do is simply honor it, witness the competing thought, and then lovingly sacrifice it and redirect your attention back to the mantra.
What about breathing in all of this?
In meditation, breathing is a preliminary. You don't give your attention to it. When you're meditating, only the mantra is to be given your conscious attention. If you are aware of the breath, it's a competing thought that has to be honored, witnessed, and sacrificed.
But aren't there some people who teach meditation and say it's all in the breathing?
As a preliminary practice, that is true. That is true.
But once you're into the meditation, the breathing is secondary.
That's correct.
All right.
And so let me just follow here, because what we're learning to do here, we are learning detachment. We're learning how to be detached from that which is attractive and pleasant and comfortable. We are telling ourselves, and this is training the mind. I'm training the mind. I'm going back to school simply by meditating. I am giving my attention to the mantra, because that's going to lead me for my highest and greatest good. Anything else, any thought, any image, any sound, is to be sacrificed. So that teaches me, when I learn how to do that, it teaches me detachment, it teaches me discrimination, and it teaches me how to exhibit my willpower to make sure that my outer actions conform with my inner wisdom. Now, that's a skill that's very valuable in the world. So when you finish your meditation practice, you now have this skill of detachment, discrimination, and willpower. So when somebody cuts me off in traffic and a thought comes forward from the unconscious mind into the conscious mind that evokes anger, I don't have to be enslaved to it. I can witness it. I can become detached from it. I can redirect my consciousness to my conscience, and my conscience will tell me whether this anger is to be served or sacrificed.
Will I live longer because I do this?
My experience is whether you live longer or not is not the key. The key is that you will live a happier, healthier life.
What about meditation and sexuality?
Well, ideally, sexuality is meditation. It is a union of the two into one. There's a whole form called Tantra that speaks to this issue. It's not about using another human being as a sexual object, but rather as a selfless act of love so that the two can merge as one.
Can you give me a little bit more on that?
Love, according to Teilhard de Chardin, the French Jesuit, love is the affinity of being with being. And so the whole idea with a sexual relation is really the same as with every relationship. I have handicaps, and my sexual partner, for example, might have handicaps. Every human mind has handicaps. Well, in order to base my outer actions on my inner wisdom, in order to share my sexual love with my partner, what I first need to do is to remember who I am and also to remember who my partner is. We are both manifestations of the divine reality. And so then I have to take a look at my mind, and I have to set aside my own handicaps, my own greed, my own fear, my own anger. And then I have to take a look at the mind of my partner and set aside theirs. When I can set aside my handicaps and set aside the handicaps of the partner, all that exists is love. And so the sexual act will be a selfless act of love where the two merge into one.
Well, if the partner, though, doesn't engage in the same sort of meditation that you do, isn't that all for naught?
It's not all for naught, because our lives become our message. The relationship that two people share is not exclusively sexual, so there are many opportunities for partners to see the value of basing outer action on inner wisdom and setting aside handicaps. So therefore, it through osmosis, other people become motivated. It's not for everybody. I grant you. You raised that issue earlier. There are people that are not ready for this. The question is, who are you, and what will bring you peace, happiness, and freedom from fear?
It's a book. It's called The Heart and Science of Yoga, A Blueprint for Peace, Happiness, and Freedom from Fear. It's by Leonard Perlmutter with his wife, Janice Cortez Perlmutter. Now, Leonard, there are 1,000 self-help books out there. No, there are
millions.
Probably millions of self-help books out there. And they're always telling you to do something in order to stop eating or to conquer addictions or to do one of those things. I take it that there is sort of a common thread through all of them. But on the other hand, there are those who would espouse very different approaches than what you've talked to us about today. And as you think about this business of the self-help business, mm-hmm. what do you come up with?
Hey, if it works for you, go with it. If not, look for something else. Look for a competent teacher in something that calls your attention.
So if I'm constantly combating, you know, extra weight, mm-hmm. is meditation something, I take it is, because you've described the process, that will help with losing weight?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Gaining weight is simply a function of the fact that an individual has entertained a thought and served that thought, perhaps in conflict with their inner wisdom.
So if I'm, you know, going to meditate, how long am I going to meditate for? You mentioned the word a minute, then you said 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. How long do you meditate?
It's different for every person. It's based on your capacity and what's easy for you. In yoga, every aspect of your practice has to be easy in order to be right. It'll be right if it's easy. So I say to people, start with 1 minute. The critical importance is not to meditate for a half hour or 45 minutes or an hour and then not meditate for 3 or 4 days or a week, but to do it every day. We're training the mind, and it's very much analogous to training a puppy dog. When we're training a puppy dog, we have to be consistent. We have to be firm. We have to be compassionate and loving. And it's the same with our mind. Nobody has taught us how to train the mind. In schools and colleges and universities, they bring us knowledge. And if we're good students, we will assimilate the knowledge. But that's where their responsibility ends, schools, colleges, and universities, with assimilated knowledge. Why? Because with assimilated knowledge, we can earn a living. But we're still enslaved to the power of the unconscious mind. What yoga science does, it takes another step beyond the knowledge, beyond the assimilation of the knowledge. It asks us to do certain practices. In real time, we are simply asked to base our outer action on our inner wisdom and be willing in the moment to forsake habits that conflict with our inner wisdom.
So if there is a movement for people to do what you're doing, but if I'm a student of politics, as you mm-hmm. know, and I watch the theory of red meat being mm-hmm. thrown,
sure.
which is you throw out red meat and you give the anger that has enslaved so many people
yes.
more meat
That's right.
to eat. And you find bodies that are different from yours. So you find, for example, gay people, and you mm-hmm. say, don't let those gay people get married. Mm-hmm. And you get a lot of votes for that
mm-hmm.
because
That's
you're
right.
going right to that bad place in all of those mm-hmm. people. Or you say, don't or don't or don't. Now, in that case, what does meditation science espouse, not for in an individual, but for a society?
Well, yoga is a personal philosophy and science. It's about changing your own consciousness. And as I mentioned before, there is only one consciousness. You know, you take a look at politicians. Politicians are merely the froth on the ocean. They are representing a certain consciousness, and their job is to get reelected. And so they will speak to certain sections of that ocean of consciousness to put together a constituency that will keep them in their job. What yoga says is this is all about a personal matter. You need to look within, and you need to purify your own instruments. Look, we are animals. You know, one of the most profound experiences that I had was watching a couple of years ago the video, and I'm sure that you saw it, a little child at a zoo fell into the gorilla cage and went and became unconscious. And the mother gorilla that was inside the cage took the child and brought the child over to the door where the zookeeper came in and out, and then the mother gorilla went all the way to the far end, away from the child, so that the zookeeper could come in and save this child. And people say, oh, how human that is. Well, there's a lot of things that we attribute to human beings that are really animal, both positive and negative. You know, all of these nature shows that you see, it becomes clear that there are many very wonderful, almost human-like qualities. But these qualities that we claim are human, they're really animal. So we are actually three in one. We are animal. We are also human. And what does that mean? It means that we have a conscience. We have a connection to the superconscious mind that will, through our conscience, teach us what to do and what not to do, which means that the human being is the conduit between the animal and the divine. And our life is a journey from the animal to the divine. So, of course, there are going to be people who are looking through the lenses, animalistic lenses, and are going to be subject to this red meat theory that you're talking about.
So you say that you've created here a blueprint for peace.
Yes.
But that peace only comes on an individual level. Each of us have to do it. And if there's a Hitler or if there's a terrible politician who decides to throw more red meat and get people more angry in order to get elected, you don't achieve your peace through yoga science.
Well, peace is an internal matter. Even in the depths of the Nazi regime in Germany, there was peace within the consciousness of Jews, even in concentration camps. It's a personal matter. You don't give up your freedom to someone else, no matter what the circumstance. You purify your own mind, and that in turn will purify the ocean of consciousness. There's only one consciousness. So it is a personal matter, but your life becomes your message. And it's a little bit like the 100-monkey phenomenon, where scientists, researchers, were observing these monkeys on South Sea Island. All the monkeys were eating the fruit that were given to them on the beach with sand on it, until one of the female monkeys cleaned off the fruit in the water. And within a very, very short time, the whole island was cleaning their fruit. Not only that, but monkeys on other islands were starting to clean their fruit. So wisdom is non-local. So by changing your own personality and purifying it, you can change the consciousness of Osama bin Laden.
The thing that confuses me, we only have 2 minutes left, it's been a terrific hour, but the thing that confuses me, of course, is that you've got some Jewish people in the Warsaw Ghetto deciding that because they are so threatened that they have to do everything in their power to fight these Nazis.
And so they do.
And so they do.
That's right.
On the other hand, you also have the Jews that you've mentioned in the concentration camp who have not fought.
Well, maybe they're fighting, but they might be at peace. It's about intention, you see. It's not saying that they don't necessarily fight. It's about being at peace and just doing what is to be done.
Okay, let's spend just a minute on you, Leonard Perlmutter. You make your living as an art dealer, but you have started this thing called the Meditation Institute, and you offer courses in different places, including some of the better-known institutions that we know of. Mm-hmm. And people could get in touch with you how?
We're in Averill Park. We have a website, AmericanMeditation.org. We're a nonprofit organization. And we also have a phone number, if that's okay. It's local. It's 674-8714.
That's 518?
518-674-8714.
And when you give these institutes, they cost some money, obviously.
Yes, there is a tuition for classes.
Okay. The book is The Heart and Science of Yoga, A Blueprint for Peace, Happiness, and Freedom from Fear. It's by Leonard Perlmutter and his wife, and it is published by AMI. And, you know, it's quite an impressive volume. So, Leonard Perlmutter, congratulations on everything you've established here. And I have to tell you, as I heard you today, there's a great deal of wisdom in what you say, and I thank you for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.